Hello, gaming intelligentsia. Before we start today's podcast, here is a message from our sponsor. The Agamenex podcast is made possible with the support from our sponsors at Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. The Pragmatic Solutions player account management platform is an incredibly powerful technology stack for today's gaming business. Their modern, modular platform provides all the core services to power your business, and their SaaS licensing model allows you to reduce cost and accelerate your strategic goals. Enterprise technology with decades of operational know-how at scale built in. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo. And now, here is today's podcast.
Future trends, deep insights, industry leaders. This is the iGaming Next podcast with your host, Pierre Lindt.
Oscar Milbach, how are you doing today?
I'm good.
Good. For the first time, we're sitting in almost what looks like a podcast studio here today, together in person.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. It feels like, for me, it's like I'm removing this like safety of having the screen behind me. Like now it's face to face. It's real. It's raw.
It's almost a bit nervous. You haven't met someone for so long, so it's being face to face like
yeah,
this.
Yeah. Exactly. But I'm happy about this today, Oscar. It's exciting to do the podcast with you.
Yeah.
It's a quite interesting subject in general. Obviously, Raketech is now kind of transforming into a very progressive company. With office moves and you are kind of taking your company remote and things like that. But before we go into that, before I researched you a little bit on LinkedIn, and I saw that I believe it's your first experience within the iGaming industry was at Mr. Green. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And I saw that you had a very interesting title there at some point, which was like Chief Venture Officer.
Yes.
And I think it's a really interesting point because it really ties in with the topic of today. First of all, I've never seen that title before, Chief Venture Officer. Can you explain a little bit about
your... I started Mr. Green as the Chief Operation Officer.
Yeah.
So back in 2016. Mm. And I had that position for some time.
Yeah.
And then eventually we wanted to, it's quite ironic actually, because we wanted to lower our dependency on affiliates. Mm. So that was like an outspoken mission, which I then got in my lap. So my job was to try to figure out how to lower our dependency from affiliates by running more venture style projects and initiatives.
Mm.
So yeah, so we made up that title and I took a group of people, we moved into our own office. So I was running that for 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because it's a very like future driven kind of role, like being like the venture, the chief venture officer, Mr. Green. And this obviously leads me to my next question, then, which is now as you're leading Raketech into the future and post corona and everything that has happened. So you guys have taken a quite radical stance, I would say, for the iGaming industry at least, to move offices to here to Soho that we are now. Mm-hmm. We are actually neighbors with each other, literally wall in wall.
Yeah.
And although you have something like 80 plus employees in Malta?
Yeah, we're 84 in Malta and 147, I think, in total.
Yeah, but still here in the office that we are now, this is not all the office that we sit in here, but you have something like 30 spots for the employees in this office.
Yes.
But obviously you have 80 plus employees. So can you explain to me a little bit what is the thought behind this move and what the how does the logic go?
Yeah, I mean, if you just say the numbers out loud, it doesn't make any sense, obviously. But this is something I've been wanting to do for a very, very long time. Even back in 10-15 years ago, I sort of identified, or at least for myself, I know that this doesn't work for everyone, but for myself, I find myself working in projects where you sometimes are you know, you're with two people doing programming or entering mm-hmm. a new country doing, and then suddenly for over the next 3 months you're 10 people working in some sort of group assignment trying mm-hmm. to reach a goal, and then the next month you're basically on your own doing Excel spreadsheets. So I realized that an office space, as we traditionally see, it's basically a copy of the old style, you know, car factory. Everyone gets their desk, they do their thing, and then they hand over to someone else. And you're measured on what you do, not what you actually deliver. Mm. You measured on your speed of assembling that little piece of whatever you do. Mm. And then basically someone copied that into an office environment. Everyone gets their desk. And, you know, I've realized over the years when every time I move to a new position within just like a physical position, every time I move for some reason, you know, an apartment grows and you have to move office, you come up with new ideas because you need to meet new people. You suddenly bump across someone else at the coffee machine and suddenly you create new ideas. Mm. So it's basically something I wanted to do personally for a very, very long time. I think the offices as they are planned today are sort of lowering the creative capacity that's built in within companies. Mm-hmm. You don't question what you do. So that's basically the fundament of it. Mm-hmm. And then also during Corona, we discovered that, because we measure staff satisfaction every week, like it's a rolling poll. So we measure and we ask questions about what works and what doesn't work and what do you appreciate and not appreciate. And we realized that communication with your manager, relationships with your peers, collaboration within projects, all of these KPIs increased. Mm. And people were working from home. Mm. And obviously we dreaded that they would go down the drain because for obvious reasons, because everyone's worked, used to be working, you know, tightly together in an office, and then suddenly everyone's spread out. Mm. So we realized that people actually enjoyed that, and productivity numbers also went up. So we delivered more projects than before. We delivered more on time in timely manners to deadline. Mm. And people were generally more happy. Mm. People that before were forced to commute, you know, maybe 45 minutes one way and then pick up their kids, could suddenly, you know, spend 15 minutes walking them to school and then coming home without having them, you know, crying and being unhappy, and then being more productive at work. Mm. So work-life balance was better, productivity. So suddenly we realized that this, in combination with the fact that we are a global company working on a global market, we just happen to basically be in Malta, is, so, you know, our future step will, you know, we might invest in Malta, we might also invest somewhere else. Yeah. It basically didn't make sense to have that same setup as we had before. So I took that as a sign of obviously then being able to run with these ideas. Yeah. I've had for many years. Yes. So we basically ran with them, and we have a fantastic HR department led by Martin Schillig. And he is also over the moon about these ideas. Mm-hmm. So we studied a lot of other companies, and he studied a lot of other companies. And then we've been running with this idea now for some time. Mm. But there are many more reasons as well, just being the simple fact that when we recruit someone, we now have a global market to recruit from. So so basically, instead of having to be forced to look for resources that are, you know, living within 35 minutes proximity to our office, which everyone else is, you know, you're limited basically to people that are, you know, is this a reasonable commute? Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere where I can park my car? Does, you know, the working hours suit my work-life balance? You know, all these questions needs to be, all these stars needs to be aligned. And then you need to find the right person as well. Not just the competence, but the culture as well. Mm. And being in Malta, or basically being everywhere, anywhere, that's a very tough cookie to, you know, that's really hard to solve. But suddenly our recruitment base is the world. Mm. So when someone quits or you know, leaves the company, we go out on a global search, and instead of settling for someone, we find the best one, which then suddenly has led to You know, before, if we searched for a specialist within a specific area, and everyone said, oh, it's impossible to find these people in Malta. Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard, especially within 35 minutes from your office. But suddenly now, instead of having like five applications, we have 250 for every role. And they're not, you know, what the normal misconception is that they would then normally be, you know, people that love to hide behind their desk, but they're not. I mean, of course, there are always those people as well, but most often they're like really super skilled people that for some reason see this as a perfect fit. So
Many reasons. I mean, there's a lot to dissect here, but what are the negatives? I mean, it can't only be positives in this change.
Well, I mean, I'm super biased, of course, because I wanted to do this for a long time. So there are some negatives, and I would say that they are, you have to put a lot more focus on the stuff that you took for granted before. So leadership, being really, really good at following up and putting expectations on everyone, but also culture, of course. How do you create this, you know, culture with human beings? We like to, you know, I mean, we have our offices next to each other, but still we chose to sit here in the same room because there is something else. But that means that we have to work harder with that. We need to spend more money, more resources on those things, which is positive, because I'm turning this negative into positive.
But that's good.
but in a normal office, you would, I'm not saying everyone is doing this, but it, in a normal office, you might not be, because you see that people are, you know, here's this person, they're working, they're doing their things. You're following them, follow them up on the work they do, but you don't really follow them up normally on what they deliver. And you don't talk much about expectations. You know, you talk about work ethics maybe, and how much time you put into something and how hard you work. But for us, that's I mean, obviously we count on everyone putting in, you know, as much work as it's required, but we have super high expectations on everyone. And we talk about the expectations, we talk about deliverables, and when you're fully remote, you can't, you know, you don't see anyone, don't see everyone all the time. So you have to be a really, really good manager. You know, you have to put really high demands, you know, sharp deadlines. You have to be very clear with expectations, you know, so there are no misunderstandings. And that has led to, you know, increase in productivity and also an increase in fulfillment, the feeling of fulfillment when you're an employee, because, you know, you actually know the expectations rather than, you know, doing something that you think might be taking the company into the right direction. Suddenly, you know what's the right direction. And then you can talk about, you know, you can get help and support if you're having problems with the actual task. But I think, so that's, I would say that it's not negative in that sense, but it's a challenge. We have to really step up, which we have, but we have, you know, a long way to go still. There are lots of things that can be improved. So, but, you know, being really good at setting expectations and talking about expectations, and then also putting a lot of effort into creating other types of social interaction to create that culture, which, you know, before you took for granted because people met at the coffee machine, or, you know, you bumped into each other in the hallway, or, you know, now we have to create these type of situations.
Exactly. Because that's what people often say, is like, you know, the office is good because a lot of the ideas comes alive next to the coffee machine, right? It's not like particularly that you need to sit by your space, but it's like by people meeting each other and circulating, that's where the ideas come from. And I think that has been a little bit like the argument against, you know, going fully remote, that you don't have this like small talk, and just like, you know, you hear someone over there saying something interesting and you join the discussion and all of a sudden a new idea comes to life.
Yeah, it is true if you don't do anything about it. But I'd say that, you know, 99% of all that small talk in the office is distracting you. And then there's 1% that's actually, you know, giving birth to a good idea.
Yeah.
So if you can isolate that 1% and maybe do that a little bit more structured, I think it's a win. Because I think a lot of these I talked to my dad the other day, and I explained, you know, he's born in the 40s, and obviously this is
very strange.
Know, very strange. And he said, you know, when I worked, he's a pensioner now. He said, when I worked, I had to go into the whole. I had to, you know, get coffee at the same time as the guys from wherever other department, because then suddenly, you know, I they said something, and then I realized that I have to change something or I have to. And I explained to him, like, Dad, we have the level of information we have today. We have 40, 50 chat channels ongoing all the time, where everyone is exchanging, you know, stuff from, you know, gifts for someone's birthday, or talks about the latest football game, or ideas about their work at the same time. It's not the lack of small talk that we, you know, we don't have that.
Okay. You can create a Slack channel, which is called Coffee Talk.
Yeah, exactly. Basically. And then you can have...
solve the problem. Yeah,
you can just follow anyone's, you know, discussions, and you see it's overload instead. So I'd say that my take on people not really embracing this, and I understand that it might not work for, you know, every company, but is mostly, with the reaction I get, is that, but how do you control that people actually do their work?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you know, you have to settle for a level of less control. But then I'd have to say that, you know, if I'm an engineer originally, and when you talk about controls, that is the typical sign of, to be a little bit provocative, but that's a sign of you having a process that doesn't work. So if you you know, if you would buy something from, you know, a typical Chinese factory, you would get these small stickers with a, you know, quality station 1, quality station 2, you know, this little, you know, stickers where someone has controlled the quality. And if you'd buy something from a Japanese manufacturer, you would never get them, right? Because their processes are designed to work, while the other ones are not designed. They design control processes because the original process doesn't work. And it's the same with this. If you're really good at setting expectations, making sure that you have the right persons in the right place, they have the right equipment, the right budget, support, training, whatever it is, that's not a problem. The problem is that you've hired the wrong persons, or you're a really bad manager.
Okay.
I mean, I'm provoking a little bit, yeah, but that's the essence of the problem.
But if you, so that's well and good, but like something that we've found, I mean, we are a much smaller organization than what you are, obviously. We are like 9 employees in our little bubble next door.
Yeah.
For us, it works great because we are all connected to each other, right? So we all discuss with each other, and me as a managing director, I feel I have pretty good control of what's happening within the organization, even though everyone works remotely. But if you are a massive company, like you know, 1,000+ employees and things like that, and if you're at the top at the C-level teams, then to give away this control of like knowing what kind of, they've created this structure where they know where they have everyone, kind of thing, it works and it's always worked. Isn't it a massive risk for an organization like that to take that step and just hoping that we have, you know, that every step of the way there is the right people? You know what I mean? Because in a big organization, maybe it's more difficult to.
Yeah, no, that's a valid point. But I think that if you would ask anyone in our organization, or anyone reporting to me, they would describe me as a control freak.
Okay.
Which is a bit contradictory, I guess. But it's about what you control. So, you know, I control over how people do things, or what they do, how they spend their time, or, you know, how much effort they put into specific things. If you know, that is the wrong type of control. But if you control what's the output of the process, so basically, you know, having really, you know, good KPIs, measuring stuff that stands out, having really good systems to be able to, you know, instantly pick up if any of the deliverables or main KPIs are, you know, pointing in the wrong direction, that is absolutely key.
That's the key.
And that is something, you know, that's, if I wouldn't have that, I wouldn't, you know, then it would just be anarchy.
Yeah.
You know, everyone could invite their own goals and do their own thing, and that doesn't work. So it's also a misconception. It's you have to have a higher level of, and I wouldn't, you know, this is a play with words perhaps, but I talk a lot about this, the difference between control and controlling. And control is when you have to, you know, make sure that, you know, everyone's doing their thing, or, you know, the, you know, in the Chinese engine example before, that everything works, mm-hmm. because you're not sure. Controlling is measuring the output. Mm-hmm. So okay. if you're measuring the output from all mm-hmm. your processes in a very, you know, sophisticated, detailed, data-driven way, you will instantly understand that, okay, something is, you know, off here,
yeah, exactly.
and then you can address that.
Yeah.
But if you go one step further down, you often tend to miss the output.
Mm.
So you can have, you know, people working really hard and yeah. everyone, but you're not really doing anything. The wheels are just spinning, and you forgot to actually look at what speed the car is going. You're looking at, you know, with what speed the wheels are turning.
Yeah.
And that is, so you have to, you know, measure the right things. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a play with words. So yeah. it's really important that you don't let control of the output, which I call would call controlling.
Yeah.
That is key. But the control over, you know, and the autonomy, I think that's important also for everyone. If I just, you know, assume that everyone is like myself, I yeah. want to have control over what I do, and, you know, but I want to have clear expectations on what to deliver.
Yeah.
And then I want to solve it in my own way. And I, yeah. you know, if I don't know how to solve something, I want to be able to, you know, say that and get support, of course. But I don't want anyone to, you know, control exactly how I do that.
No, exactly. So it's like if you boil it down in engineering language to like a short sentence, it would be what matters is not the input. What matters is only the output.
The input matters and the output matters.
But if you have good output, then the rest doesn't matter. No? Like if you create that output in, let's say, in 2 hours, mm. or if you do the same output in 100 hours, it doesn't matter. Like the only thing that matters is what is the output.
Yeah, but then that means that the input is 100 hours.
Yeah.
And in one of the examples, and the other example is the input is 2 hours, and that obviously costs us a lot more, the 100 hours.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, yeah.
But what you do yeah. with the hours, that yeah. that... I mean, obviously, we want to be as efficient as possible, but that is for all the experts we have. I mean, we have 147 super skilled persons, and they will be, you know, the likelihood of me being even remotely as skilled as each and every one of them, you know, I would have to be, you know, Einstein times 10, because it's not impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have super experts within a lot of fields, and for me or for their manager or for their manager's manager to go in and, you know, be better at them.
Mm.
You know, if I have 10 people reporting to me, I would at best know 10% of what they know. And then I would know maybe, you know, a little bit about my own job as well, you know, and that would make me super skilled.
Yeah.
Right. But it's a bit naive to think that you would be able to know more than the people in your team.
Mm.
I mean, either if you do that, you probably hired the wrong persons.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to hire people that are much better than yourself, dealing with what happens after you put in the money and the hours. They do their magic and out comes something, and that's what you measure, what you put in and what comes out. And then obviously if something's, you know, happening here, suddenly we start getting less output from the input, or you know, the quality is not as good, whatever happens, then you have to go in and help these people. But within that field, they are the experts.
It's like, yeah, but I think it was Steve Jobs who said that we don't hire people to tell them what to do, we hire smart people so they tell us what to do.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah. And would you say then, okay, so instead of what matters is only the output, not the input, would you say then optimal output with efficient input?
I think this is just we're saying the same thing, but I think from the engineering perspective,
exactly.
input is the resources and the time you put in, or whatever you put in, the you know, the whatever you pour in, and then something happens, that's the process. And so you measure both input and output, and hopefully the process here should enrich. So you pour in 10 euros here, and once this is finished, it's 11. So you measure the difference between input and output, and that's what you, but exactly what happens in here, that's why we have all these experts, that's why we have all these 147 fantastic people that are that are doing their magic. I don't need to, you know, and I don't know how to, because they are, you know, they are skilled. Yeah. And that's why they are hired.
Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. So, I mean, talking about like job roles and, you know, not understanding exactly what's going on sometimes within this organization, like, I mean, the life of a CEO in general, Oscar, I mean, can you explain a little bit, like, from your position and your point of view? I mean, you deal with massive pressure, obviously. I mean, you're the CEO of a listed company, which brings a lot of pressure, obviously, and questions from the shareholders and things like that. Like, how do you deal with the pressure of being a CEO in general? You mentioned that you're a control freak. Do you think is the pressure that's making it? Does that make it worse?
I'd say that. It sounds corny now when I say it, but I have a motto for myself, and that is to take whatever I do very seriously, but not myself.
Okay. Yeah.
And that just makes everything very, very easy. So I don't take myself very seriously, because then, you know, if you the moment you start taking yourself seriously, that's when you end up in these bad circles. You should take what you do seriously. You should be proud over what you produce and what you deliver.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to remember that, you know, you just happen to have one position somewhere, and everyone is playing a part of it. Mm. And what you should be proud over is the output again, and not, you know, me as the, you know, the process itself.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I think, and this is also something I don't think, you know, no one believes it, but I've never ever strived towards a career. I've never had that as an objective.
Okay. You know, has been your motivator?
Driving, inventing, bringing things forward.
Like creating things. Like
being creating things. You know, when I was 20, I started to become an engineer. I had a marketing company called Fast Forward, and we made this little leaflet of like a pamphlet that we handed out to all the students, and we managed to get companies to buy their advertisement space in this one, and we made no money. We turned over some, but we didn't make any money. But that was, you know, one of the best times of my life. Mm. You know, we invented something from thin air that was appreciated by the people that, you know, the companies that bought the ads and the students that got like discount vouchers. Mm-hmm. It was brilliant. Mm. You know, I learned a lot, but the satisfaction of actually, you know, taking something and making it, you know, worth more, because you have an idea about how to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. That is what gives me satisfaction.
Because something I noticed now as I keep kind of slowly growing our organization, and kind of more and more pressure mounts, and, you know, you need to deliver, and targets are getting higher and things like that. It's for me, it's getting... I can feel that the pressure is mounting, so to say. If I compare myself to a couple of years ago, my life was a lot more carefree, let's say. Mm. And just like you, I mean, in the beginning of our existence, of our organization, you know, 100% passion. We didn't care at all about making money. It was purely because we loved what we're doing and things like that. But as time goes by, you know, you can feel the pressure mounting. Like, how do you, I mean, now, you're the CEO now of a listed company, way, way over where kind of my organization, we are just me and two other shareholders, you know, that's the only thing we have to worry about. But how do you deal with this pressure? I mean, you know, let it not spill over? Because you can easily work 24 hours per day with the tasks that are given to you.
But don't lose that first feeling, because that's that's your fuel. Mm. You should have that forever, and that's something I've, you know, promised myself. I've of course made a lot of mistakes during my career, and one of the things that I've learned is that I want to keep what you just described as the beginning of your company, because then it's not worth it. So I want to see RegTech. That's why I'm like, I love my job. I love everyone that works here. I love what we do.
Yeah.
And I want to make it better and larger. And I want, you know, everyone to understand how great we are. Not because I'm the CEO of a stock listed company. That's great. But because I want to contribute and do something.
Mm.
And Yeah, and then if there comes a day when, you know, shareholders or someone wants to run in a different direction, something that, you know, that I'm not good at or that I'm you know, don't believe in or whatever it is, then I will step to the side. It's the you know, because the job itself, I mean, it means a lot. You know, I can support my family, I have a lot, you know, I have fun, and, you know,
of course.
But that's not what's the most important thing. What drives me is what we can, you know, that feeling you described in the beginning, that should be the driver.
But that can also, I mean, yes, I love that feeling too, but that can also consume you as well, that feeling. Like for me, for example, I love working. I mean, I love taking care of the company and these things, but there's a constant battle between that and keeping myself in shape, keeping my relationships going and things like that. And I've come to the point now where, like, some of my friends are on this level as well as CEOs and things. And oftentimes they struggle with this balance. And I think that, you know, something I realize more and more is, like, the better balanced you are as a person, the better you will also do your job.
Yeah, obviously. You know?
But it's a constant battle because I love going into work, you know, at 9 in the morning and leaving at, you know, 9 p.m. In the evening, you know. And I could easily get sucked into that. But then that would be a sacrifice on the private side. You know? And I think as you go along, you learn more and more perhaps how to balance those two.
How is it for you? I have a very, you know, those who know me, and we talked about processes before, I'm very process-oriented. And my wife's probably going to kill me now. But we have a very structured process for exactly this.
Yeah.
So I was, this is 12 years ago when we were, I think it was 12 years ago, when we were expecting our first child. I was in a situation where I was, just like you described, worked a lot for something I was passionate about, but it had become something else. And it took a lot of my happiness away. And we were in the, you know, happiest times of our life, expecting the first child and everything. So I just had to, you know, get an answer to these more philosophical questions. You know, why are we doing this? What to motivate me? So every year since then, in February, we go to what we call, you know, a family conference. and we have a strategy conference for the family. And it's just me and my wife. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, and it sounds super boring, of course, but you could, it's basically, you choose a hotel somewhere, you go there, you make sure the kids are taken care of, you have a really nice dinner, and you talk about what's important in life. That's the question you talk about. So, and you never, I mean, you're in this wheel and you never actually talk about what's important in life. When are you happy?
Yeah.
When are you sad? You constantly talk about, you know, I want to have a house, I want to have a car, what's the next position? You talk about these practical things, but you never actually talk about what's the goal? Why are we doing this? Just like we talked with the process before. You don't talk about the actual delivery. Why?
Or you get stuck in the day-to-day.
Yeah, you get stuck in the day-to-day.
Without looking at what direction you're going to, perhaps.
Exactly. So we basically actually then, so we talk about what's important. And then we realize that, you know, what's important in life? When are we the most happy? And then we realize, when we're in reasonably good shape, that's really important. Yeah, okay, so that's one thing. We write it down. When we spend a lot of time with family and friends. Okay, yeah. I mean, everyone has probably the same, but you don't really talk about
it. No, you don't. Yeah.
When we're not feeling stressed about, you know, our financial situation. Or, you know, and we list 3-4 things that are like, these things, when they're good, we're really happy. And then we name them life goals, and that's like that's life goals. And then we break that down into 5, 3, and 1 year actions. So basically, then we have an answer to so when you're stressed and you're doing something, you can remind yourself that this is basically, you know, a part of the journey to the life goals.
Yeah,
which then sort of makes you can still have the pressure, but you don't have the stress. So you have the press, but not the stress, because it's part of your journey, and you can motivate and you can feel happy about things, situations, and you're both on board with it, right? Because like maybe your what you're doing is the step onto something that will be, you know, your common goal for you know, the next upcoming years. Maybe that will, you know, introduce you to, you know, something that will then lead to something. And then it's easier for you, you know, as a couple, as a family, to, you know, motivate these late nights at the, you know, because you know it's not long term, it's part of a... Yeah. So that's basically how we solved it. And then we revisit it every year and we say, okay, so what, you know, were we happy last year? Yeah, we were happy last year. Yeah, why? Because we did all these things. Yeah, fantastic. We said no to these, when I was in between jobs, between Mr. Green and this job, I had, you know, there was massive amounts of different opportunities that arised. But I turned so many down because they were not. I turned them down because they were not ticking the boxes. You know, it could have, you know, potentially given me fame and glory and sometimes money, but they were not ticking the boxes. But this was ticking the boxes. You know, so
super interesting. So it's like a board meeting for the relationship.
Long term.
Yeah. But you look at it, it's like you take a helicopter view over your relationship then, or your life, and you just basically pragmatically, without emotions involved or whatever, you pragmatically talk about what do we want in our lives, basically, and that takes prioritization, you know.
Yeah, and not the first years were difficult because then, you know, we ended up talking about. We mixed up the life goals with practical things. So you would instantly translate your life goal into, you know, yeah, we want a house at close to the sea. But no, that's not a life goal. That doesn't bring you happiness.
No, that's more a result of the work you're doing.
I'm really this year, you know, when we. My wife and I went to compete in the World Series of Swim Run. So we went to VAR. Cool. And that experience was just amazing. Trained together as a couple, talked about what we ate and how we trained. And we went, you know, I started picked up swimming. And then we traveled there. It was this, you know, 7-6 hour race.
Yeah.
And we made it together. That I was happy. She was happy. That was, you know, amazing experience. Mm. And then we backtracked that and say, okay, what happened? Yeah, we trained together.
Yeah.
We were in good shape. You know, we did stuff together in the nature. You know, so those are then important factors for us to, you know, be able to have a life that includes these type of things.
It's super interesting. This is like proper, it's like CEO relationship advice. I've never heard about this before, but a yearly review of the relationship and what brings you happiness.
I think sounds that's boring, super, but I think it's
super cool. Yeah. I'll tell you, from my own life, like I'm single, so I can't have this except for my dog. We can have a yearly call,
but it's
more a one way conversation. But I measure my happiness as well, but on a more broken down day to day level. I measure my happiness every day from 1 to 10.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
From 1 to 10 every day. And
an app for it, or?
There's an app, yeah. I can't remember the name of it now. I can check. Yeah, okay. If you want to see it at some point, it's called, let's see here, iMood Journal. So it's basically... It looks like this.
Ah, that's brilliant.
It is it's like 1 to 10. I don't know if it's visible in the camera, but... And at the same time, I measure other things too. So I have the Fitbit then, so it measures my daily heart rate. It's noted as well, like which day of the week, then I'm more happy and stuff. And then every so often, I put all of this data into an Excel sheet. And I analyze when I am the happiest.
I love this.
Because the reason for this is, and the reason that it's important to do it at the same day, like you shouldn't fill in your happiness what it was a week ago. You should do it the same day.
Same time, every day.
Because your experiencing self is very different from how you remember things.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have a memory that seems wonderful or that seems horrible, but in the moment it's being perceived very differently.
Yeah.
So, you know, the traditional things is like, I'm the happiest when I go to the beach or something. I don't know what it might be, but something that I realized for myself is like I am the happiest when I am active. So it doesn't matter if I had like a great day at work. Okay, it's going to make me happier for sure. Or if it's my birthday, or if it's a nice surprise that happens to me in my life or whatever. But if I, when I exert myself physically, that's when I'm, that's when I'm the happiest. It's very, it's a, almost like a contradictory thing. But as an example, I went to Thailand in February and I did a Thai boxing camp. So I'm a boxer. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. You know, every day we were training super hard, you know.
But you were happy.
Yeah, and I didn't party anything. I didn't drink anything for 2 weeks or anything. But when I reviewed that time in my app, that's like there's a big bulge during that time when I'm like the happiest. It's very interesting
it's basically the same thing as I mean, it sounds like very similar to what we're doing, but it's very in a very systematic way. I love it.
Very, very pragmatic way of measuring happiness. Yeah, and my friends, we have a common friend, Lassen.
Yeah,
he laughs at me because I do this, you know.
He's in a funny way, he laughs at it,
but he's also a little bit impressed, I think, by this. But it's there's so much information you can get from this. Even like, okay, I'm super interested in myself and my own development. So like, what is the difference between seasons? What is the difference between day of the week? You know what I mean? Is there any correlation with a lower resting heart rate and happiness? So my resting heart rate fluctuates. Okay, so is there a correlation between happiness and a lower heart rate? You know, because that would mean that if I'm a bit in better
that
shape,
you're fit,
I'm generally happier as well. Yeah. So I'm analyzing this now as well, and I can tell you like some of the results. I can tell you it's I'm the least happy on Thursdays, actually, for some reason. So, surprisingly enough, I guess I'm a bit more
tired. Is it significantly different, or is it, could it be coincidence, or is it like Thursdays are they're absolutely.
I mean, it's a measurable difference between the days. Mm-hmm. So you can see, for example, on Saturdays is the happiest day. I mean, not surprisingly enough. Yeah. But I think on Thursdays, you're generally a little bit more tired. Like it's like towards the end of the week, but it's not the end of the week. Yeah. You know what I mean? And there is a correlation as well between the lower resting heart rate.
That's a given.
Yeah. Even if I don't train that day, you know, it's still a correlation between that. So my ideas and like in my head is that, you know, in a couple of years, if I measure this over the year, I want to see a trend. If my life, I want to see a trend if age changes happiness as well.
Interesting.
I want to really study these trends like deeply to understand. I don't know if it's it's too much or whatever.
No, it's just spot on, Pierre. Spot on. Everyone should. No, but I think it's, I mean, we're basically doing the same then. Trying to figure out what are the, you know, not the immaterial things, the other things that makes us happy. And I mean, you've isolated a few things there with training and, you know, there's probably some more social things and then you should try to set up goals where I should do more of that.
Exactly.
And how can I form my life so that I make more of the stuff that makes me happy?
Yeah, exactly.
Because that then you won't be blinded by, you know, what's on your business card or what, you know, you have the drive for the right reasons.
Yeah, exactly. And you realize as well, like it's perhaps also a fast track to realize that money is not that happiness either. And I think that's really important realization in life in general, that like money isn't happiness. Like you mentioned before that like the goal would be to have the nice house, you know, or the nice car.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion. Yeah. Yes. It's a short-term happiness perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if I can ask you a deep question then, Oscar, like what is happiness to you?
I'd say that they are very much correlating to my life goals. Mm. So it's freedom, and it's being reasonably fit, and then, you know, the most important one would be the social parts, family, friends, you know, having time, being. I notice, for instance, that I don't measure it like you do, but I'll get there. But I notice that I'm a much better, you know, dad and much better, you know, husband and friend and leader when I'm in, you know, when I'm feeling good about myself. So all of these things are correlating. But yeah, that's it basically.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I mean, to go full circle with this discussion, I think what you are talking about, you know, having more time friends, having more time for your family, like being able to do social activities. Like that is what you are giving your employees now by this type of structure, right? Like allowing them to work from home or to work from anywhere, saving them the time of commute, or being able to, you know, plan their day a little bit more flexible. So, I mean, in a sense, do you think that like your own life values are reflected in how you drive your company?
I haven't
forward.
Thought about that, but that's yeah. that. I mean, I guess that would be a reasonable conclusion to come to. I guess,
Because if we look forward now, I mean, progressive companies in the past, there's always been this, you know, news articles. We spoke about this a little before the podcast, but like. There's always been this like hyped up news articles before Corona happened with like, you know, company X, they allow their employees to work 3 hours a day and their productivity increased 1,000% or whatever. And there was a lot of talk before about like this like short work day. You never saw this hyped article about working from home particularly. But it seems like that discussion have completely died out now. There isn't a discussion about shortening the workday
no,
anymore.
No, that's right.
It's all about working with freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to work 12 hours a day if you have to, but as long as you get your freedom, like do that from wherever you want. That seems to be the future in general.
Yeah, I'd say, I think so. But I mean, it doesn't. It's not one size fits them all. And I also think that one thing that you forget a lot of times when you talk about leadership or structures in terms of organizations is that, you know, all these people, they, you know, they read these books about, you know, how to manage things. But it's, you know, I wouldn't be able to manage in any other way, regardless which books I read. You know, I can get an idea or two about, you know, concrete tip, but it's about me and who I am and, you know, what drives me. And it's like, if you look at, you know, Elon Musk or, you know, who else on the other side, Bill Gates.
Yeah.
I mean, super successful, both of them, two completely different persons. Yeah. And, you know, Elon Musk, he wouldn't be probably terrible at Microsoft, or maybe he would be great actually. But, you know, if you would put a military in charge of a children's group or, you know, a children's teacher in charge of a military, I mean, obviously it doesn't work, but they're not both necessarily bad leaders. They're just, you know, and you wouldn't be able to, you know, have a military read a book about, you know, it doesn't fit. So it has to be coming from you as a leader, because then I think, you know, that's where many companies go wrong as well. They read this book and, you know, if someone would try to copy our concept of how we work and they don't really believe in it, they still don't really trust their employees. They do it because it's modern or something, or you know, they don't work with the expectations and the delivery management. They still work with controlling their work process.
Yeah,
they would fail obviously.
Yeah.
So I think you have to it's a, you know, these things goes in waves and we'll see where we end. But I think you have to really believe in what you do as a leader and run with it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are organizations that would, you know, work completely different from us but still be super successful because they have a leader that believes in something else. And you know,
it's a good point in general, because you see a lot of these like self-help kind of people, or the people who educate like how should you be a leader, and it's a very specific way, like you should do this, you should do that. But they often disregard the fact that we are different personalities with different values in our lives and working in different organizations with different cultures. A lot of times, like this is, do you know, like Simon Sinek, for example. I'm not a big fan of him actually, because I think that he is a typical, like, well-spoken, articulate person, but he doesn't actually have that much managerial experience himself.
Right.
But he's very good at
he's very good at it.
And he was arguing that, like, you know, Gen X and Gen Z, they are, it's like the worst generation. They don't know how to interact. They don't know how to have a conversation with each other. And therefore, they are at a massive disadvantage against our generation. And I just felt, you know what? This is what every old dinosaur generation in history have said about the younger generation.
It's repeating itself.
Just repeating itself, completely disregarding the fact that the world around them is changing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They don't need to have this like in-person discussion. They can have a discussion on the other side of the world from each other via computer. You know what I mean? And they'll get exactly the same amount of work done or whatever that's as you would before. Just like the older generation would have said about us.
Yeah, obviously.
Like, you know, on the like the new generation, they are not strong enough to carry the potatoes on their shoulder. They'll never be able to have a great farm.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's irrelevant. We don't want to be farmers. We want to...
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? We want to create tech companies. You know what I mean? Like, it's a different generation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my kids, when I bring out the toolbox to fix something in the house, they're like, is that a hammer? No, that's a screwdriver.
Yeah.
So they have no idea.
It's irrelevant to them, you know?
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, I have to go to them and, you know, this latest update in Apple, it you know, it screwed up my phone and they're like, yeah, give it to me.
Are you not that bad? I hope
no, not really.
But
not
almost,
really.
Almost.
But
yeah.
almost.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Brilliant, Oskar. I think that's a great way to wrap things up today. This has been a fantastic session, sitting in person. It's a nice experience, actually. I think we're not there yet to go fully digital yet. I think these discussions have something extra to them. So
good.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this, Oskar. And we're neighbors, so we can always wave at each other. Yeah,
absolutely.
Year, so, yeah.
All right. That's how
you do it. Thank you.
This fruitful discussion has been brought to you by our sponsors, Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. Is your business struggling to keep up with the development demands on your current gaming platform? Well, then it's time to upgrade to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Multi-tenant, multi-currency, multi-regional, API-based, rule engine automated, regulation-ready, it's all here out of the box. Smart businesses leverage Pragmatic SaaS model and license powerful modern technology for a fraction of the cost of in-house development. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo. Stay safe and take care.